I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Blaine Elementary School sits in a low-income neighborhood in Philadelphia where many students struggle to achieve. Principal Janine Powell decided that it was time to make some changes at Blaine, hiring a team of teachers willing to do things differently. Last year, they began to put some of those reforms into place. WHYY Newsworks education reporter Kevin McCory spent a lot of time at Blaine last year, talking with the principal, the teachers, parents, and students about the challenges they faced and their hopes for the school. Today in Radio Times, we present Kevin's documentary, Turnaround, A Year Inside a Strawberry Mansion Elementary School.
Maureen Brower faced a choice. It was March of 2014. She'd been teaching at Blaine Elementary School in North Philadelphia's Strawberry Mansion neighborhood for 5 years. The more years she taught, the more she felt that she was making a positive difference in students' lives. But then she became increasingly filled with doubt when, as the years went by, many of her former students, a few grades older, seemed to be sailing adrift.
It would make me upset because I felt like all the work that I had done was now undone. And I didn't know how to fix it. And I wanted to fix it.
Brower often took her frustrations home, venting them to her husband.
My kids that I've had are not my kids anymore. I don't know where they went. I don't know what happened to them. And I need to fix them. And I don't know how. And then I would usually cry.
Part of the problem, Brower says, came from a lack of cohesion among the faculty.
In previous years, we haven't always had 100% of teachers following through with things. So they were just kind of set in their ways of just doing the same thing over and over again.
The school's principal, Janine Powell, had become increasingly frustrated with this as well.
You know, you just have to have the right people on board who want to do the same type of work, not coming in at a certain time and leaving at a certain time and knowing that this is, you know, hard work. And hard work takes, you know, lots of time outside of the school day.
Late in the 2013-14 school year, Powell began pushing to make a big change. With the school district's consent, Blaine Elementary had been working on a plan to reimagine the school. Through that process, Powell hoped to exercise a clause in the teacher's contract that allows half of a school's faculty to be pushed out for a turnaround effort. But she didn't want to do it unless there was support among the school's teacher leaders, including Brower. Brower and the leadership team mulled it over. Eventually, they voted yes, and then helped Powell interview new applicants for their former college jobs.
Seeing my most successful students not be so successful anymore, that made me want to make a change. Needed to make a change for the kids and the community to become better.
That vote happened in March of 2014, and soon after, all teachers had to reapply for their jobs. Pro-union school advocates cried foul, and some of the faculty complained of being left in the dark. This was Principal Powell in April 2014.
I did sit down one-on-ones with each one of the teachers, and they were able to say if they wanted to be here. Some of them said, no, you know, this is a great opportunity for me to take my years and go to another school.
A new slate of teachers was hired with the promise that the shakeup would vastly improve student achievement. Since then, for more than a year, through dozens of interviews with parents, students, teachers, and staff, I've tracked Blaine's attempt at transformation and found that the stakes for this work are immense. Children, parents, and grandparents have hopes and dreams hanging in the balance. Teachers and staffers devote themselves wholly to the cause, often sacrificing their personal lives. And at bottom, there's a question that is of utmost importance to the city of Philadelphia. Can the school district revitalize a chronically low-performing school in one of the most poverty-stricken neighborhoods in the city in the midst of an ongoing budget crisis? A school like Blaine does not, cannot, simply teach reading, writing, math, and science. Sitting in the heart of Strawberry Mansion, the K-8 school absorbs the problems and issues that plague the surrounding community.
And when you turn the TV on, what do you see? And what do you hear? Someone gunned down in the Strawberry Mansion area. on such street in his...
Rosalinda Harris's son was in Blaine's fourth grade this past year.
It never fails. If you look at the statistics of the neighborhood, and you was a teacher or a staff member in that school, you wake up, you listening to that every day, you about to come to a war zone.
The predominantly African-American school sits in a neighborhood where the median household income is about $20,000. About a quarter of the adults in the neighborhood have less than a high school education. Almost a quarter of the student body has a special education disability. When kids come to Blaine, they're often years below grade level in reading and math, and many arrive weighed down by social, emotional, and behavioral burdens. Andrew Brooking teaches 6th and 7th grade math.
Our needs in the school are so high. Like, kids, the stories you get, the families you get, parent-teacher conferences. I was, you know, like, I had one day, you know, five or six parents were, you know, bawling in the conferences, crying because, you know, they want their kids to do so well, but they're dealing with so many challenges outside of school that get in the way of them being able to, you know, really affect change in their own kids' life. And it's just, that's the neighborhood.
The school district did not give Blaine any extra resources for the turnaround effort. So, like many elementary schools in the city in the past few years, Blaine does not have a full-time nurse, guidance counselor, or school police officer, which often leaves those tasks to Principal Powell.
I am like a CEO of a school instead of the instructional leader because, you know, I am the nurse. I'm in the counselor part-time. You know, I'm filling in for all of the things that are missing within the school.
In the face of such vast problems and systemic deficiencies, the whole idea of turnaround can seem Sisyphean. But this past year brought differences that many say have made an important impact. Cynthia Thomas has two young children at the school.
They painted inside. They fixed it up real nice. It's gorgeous inside.
It's these outward, physical differences that tend to catch the eye on first glance. New paint job, new school logo, more technology in the classroom, college banners hanging above every door. For parent Andrea Garrett, it's the school's new student uniform policy, sharp white Oxford shirts and burgundy sweaters.
It's teaching them how to dress different, you know, not just jeans and t-shirts. It's teaching them how to be responsible and how to be in the world. You know, when they go to work and apply for jobs, you got to dress a certain way.
There are other important changes, too. The school day is an hour longer, 4 days of the week, allowing students to be released early on Wednesdays so that staff can meet for professional development and collaboration. Student data are now regularly tracked, shared with parents in real time, and discussed among faculty. Principal Powell's vision is that of a laboratory where teachers are in constant open dialogue about how to improve classroom instruction.
It's not like a put down. It's like, no, we're identifying a concern and we are addressing that concern and then we're practicing. So, you know, practice making perfect and then going into that classroom ready to go.
Openness itself has become a mantra. Parents are free to come to the school whenever they wish and classroom doors are not to be closed.
Yeah, absolutely. They have to open their doors and anybody can walk in and they can give feedback to each other openly and not be fearful to ask questions or say, I don't know.
Blaine's turnaround effort was aided by a $1.5 million grant from the Philadelphia School Partnership. That's the money that gave the school a facelift, paid for a turnaround consultant, and sent Powell to a year-long intensive principal training program. The grant came to the school in large part because of the organization's faith in Principal Powell, who's been at the school for 7 years.
My personal life, I don't have one. I'm a single mom, two kids. I have a 6-year-old and a 12-year-old. So they know whenever I come home, we're sitting at the table, we're doing homework, and mommy's doing work too. And they know that, you know, this is very important. They come here. They are, when they're on their days off, they'll sit in the classrooms.
In the first few years especially, the work of changing school culture and rapidly improving student ability is often grueling and frustrating. It takes educators who are willing to devote an almost unhealthy amount of time to a job where hurdles are high, setbacks are often, and progress can seem like a mirage.
I mean, if I'm going to do something, I want to do it right. That's it. Like, I don't... What drives that is it's a passion deep down.
Again, math teacher Andrew Brooking.
I don't think I'd want a job where I just go home, 5 o'clock, shut the light off, and I'm done. So I think that's just a personality thing.
Brooking is one of the new teachers at Blaine, one who came in after the big shakeup. He's big bearded with deep brown eyes, evoking visions of a beat poet at the blackboard. In his early 20s, he left upstate New York to help underserved communities in Mexico, Chile, and California. In 2010, he zagged back across the country in a U-Haul to teach in Philadelphia. Before Blaine, he taught at one of Kipp's Philadelphia charter schools. There, he says he learned to be a relentlessly effective educator. At Blaine, he has a partner teacher, also newly arrived from Kipp, which only accepts students through a lottery.
She and I, like, both know, lived, and saw what it means to make a super effective classroom. Kids that are growing 3 years in 1 year, we know what that looks like, feels like, and sounds like in a way. I know that it's possible, so why not go back to a place where you don't have to be lucky to be there?
Talking to Brooking as he lived through Blaine's year of turnaround revealed the highs and lows of the work. It also raised questions about its sustainability. Brooking comes to Blaine at 6 a.m. every day and doesn't leave until 6 p.m. At age 31, he has no designs on a marriage or a family.
It's almost like a birth control, just working with kids here all the time. I don't have any desire to have children at this point because I feel like I have, 30 of them, right now.
When we talked in August 2014, during the first week of school, he was upbeat, confident, and excited. By December, it was a different story.
Last time we talked, it's been August. Wow. It's like a whirlwind, I feel like,
After months of living and breathing the challenges, Brooking seemed tired.
I think going every day with the high expectations can wear you down a little bit, can be challenging. And we're going through the work right now. And so is it sustainable? I don't know. I think for me, I personally don't see myself teaching, right, 10 years from now.
For those on the outside, without much experience in schools, it can be hard to understand why great gains aren't made more often in chronically underperforming schools. The conversation often turns to a debate. One side questions the adequacy of resource levels, while the other questions the effectiveness or dedication of educators. Blaine now has what a lot of reformers seek, a trusted school leader working with a teaching force hand-picked to carry out her vision. Still, interview after interview led back to one word: funding.
Before I worked in a school, I didn't realize that everyone can work their absolute hardest, and if you're not getting all the funding you need, that you're just still going to be suffering.
Cynthia Jones came to the school this past year through AmeriCorps to coordinate community outreach.
I kind of just thought, if everybody tries their best, I'm sure it could work out, but it's a lot more complicated than I thought it was.
As the school year progressed, Andrew Brooking found himself in an existential struggle. He came to Blaine thinking he'd only stay as long as he felt the turnaround was making a real, substantial difference. By the midpoint in the year, he was constantly questioning the school's progress and taking an increasingly skeptical role among faculty.
So I'll talk to my other leadership members and they're like, you should have seen last year. Like, this is, and I'm like, so? I'm like thinking, we need to keep pushing. We need to, this is not good enough. And I think that's been the consistent thing in my head is, we are not there. We are not close.
You're listening to Turnaround. WHYY education reporter Kevin McCrory's documentary about reform efforts at Blaine Elementary School in Philadelphia, a special edition of Radio Times.
Blaine's turnaround attempt is one of two that were unveiled by the district last year. Kelly Elementary School, just a few blocks away from Blaine, was the other. Both stand in stark relief to the district's previous turnaround model, which labeled some schools promise academies. That model, introduced by a previous superintendent, was much more of a top-down, cookie-cutter approach, which fizzled when budget cuts stripped away at its supports. Much of Andrew Brooking's anxiety about Blaine comes from his distrust of the school district bureaucracy. He spent his first few years as a teacher in a North Philadelphia Promise Academy and felt that that model had little impact on kids' lives.
It's hard to find a place that you think you believe in and you believe that's going to work. My problem has been putting hard work into something that isn't worth it.
Blaine and Kelly represent a new direction for the district. The principals have been given autonomy to recreate schools as they see fit. Staff have come together to create something from the bottom up, and the central office largely stays out of the way. Principal Powell offered us incredible access to Blaine to report this story. She okayed every request without hesitation. She was giving of her own time and willing to share her hopes, frustrations, and details of her personal life. Interviews with other staffers were allowed freely, as were those with parents in the schoolyard. For many schools, maybe especially Philadelphia neighborhood schools, this can be a frightening prospect. The safest course of action for principals is to refuse all requests and deflect inquiry to central administration. Powell's course gave a much more comprehensive view of Blaine, scars and all. Towards the end of the year, I sat in on a parent meeting that gave a stark view of some of those scars.
It's a cover-up. It looked cute on the outside, but what's going on in the inside?
Rosalinda Harris was one of about 10 parents who came to the meeting that morning. There was supposed to be a presentation given by the Red Cross, but when that fell through at the last minute, the meeting devolved into a complaint session. Parents were either upset about the shortage of support staffers in the building or about how an individual academic or behavioral infraction was handled with their child. Again, Rosalinda Harris.
Only thing I see change is a couple little bit of paint on the walls and some uniforms.
This meeting led me to deeper conversation with two different guardians with wildly different takes on the turnaround effort. One extremely critical of the status quo, another greatly encouraged and hopeful for the future. Rosalinda Harris is the critic. Her son, Chance Nelson, was born with half of a heart.
I had heart surgery when I was a baby.
Chance is 11 now and will go into the fifth grade this year. Because of his condition, he's smaller physically for his age, looking like he was 8 or 9. Rosalinda was to have twins, but learned of severe complications during pregnancy. Chance's brother died during labor. Chance survived, but needed open-heart surgery immediately. Doctors at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia warned that he could be paralyzed for the rest of his life. Rosalinda raises Chance alone. His biological father, who Chance has never met, is serving time in a federal prison. The stepfather, who helped raise him, was shot and killed as a victim of a robbery in 2013, the same year Rosalinda had a career debilitating stroke. Chance has defied expectations, but he's needed critical medical attention many times throughout his life. And now, as an elementary school student, although on first glance he looks like any other healthy kid, Rosalinda says he's extremely fragile.
I'm trying to make them aware he has a feeding tube on his stomach. He, with the signs to look for if he can't breathe, stuff like that, how important it is not to make him walk up that says, okay, to come down. Don't make him stress the heart more than what it needs to do. But if he mishandled properly, it becomes a fatal issue. And half of the staff didn't even know, like, his issue. And that's the stuff that I'd be trying to make them aware of.
But all doesn't always go as planned.
He comes home from school and tell me he was playing football with a long scrape up his arm like this. I don't get no phone call. He's on blood thinners. They couldn't stop it bleeding. Of course he's on blood thinners. This is why AIP is put in place to tell you he's not allowed for physical contact sports.
During one of our interviews, Rosalinda and I talked inside the narrow Strawberry Mansion row home she rents. The battery alert signal for some of the smoke detectors in the house beeped consistently through our conversation.
The landlord, he put batteries in one, but the batteries, they don't last long.
Most of Rosalinda's complaints about the school aren't aimed at Principal Powell. She appreciates the attempt at turnaround, but what kind of school, she asks, has no nurse?
So imagine if I was sending him there with medication. Do you think I'd be safe with him, them giving him his medicine? No, because y'all don't have a nursing staff every day of the week like y'all used to have.
It's impossible to talk about Blaine without acknowledging the systemic inequities of Pennsylvania's education funding model, which the U.S. Department of Education has flagged as the most inequitable in the nation. In other states, Blaine would receive more funding based on its population of high poverty, high need students. In Pennsylvania, those factors don't come into account. There is a bipartisan drive to implement a fairer formula, but there continues to be a deep divide between first-year Democratic Governor Tom Wolf and the Republican-held legislature over Wolf's proposal to drastically increase education spending. Rosalinda Harris has witnessed how Pennsylvania's systemic inequities trickle down to a school like Blaine. Last year, Chance was frequently bullied in the stairwells and one day attacked by a group of students in the bathroom.
There's not enough staff in the hallways, bathrooms, cafeteria, none of that, to support these kids as far as being safe. If you're not safe, how can you learn? That's the whole thing in a nutshell.
Despite the obvious resource deficiencies, many in the Blaine community readily acknowledge that more money will not heal all wounds.
I've seen a lot. You know, I've been there for a long time, 22 years.
Rashid Abdullah has been at Blaine longer than anybody, mostly as a math teacher. Now he teaches computer science, where he interacts with kids in every grade, K to 8.
You see early pregnancies. You see children, you know, getting caught up in the judicial system. It bothers me when I see children, you know, grow up and get caught up by that, by the environment. You know, and the environment takes these, you know, wonderful, bright-eyed children, you know, and leads them down a, you know, wrong path.
Abdullah grew up in Strawberry Mansion and followed in his father's footsteps as a Philadelphia public school teacher. In two decades at Blaine, he's become like a father figure, one whom kids respect and flock to. The elephant in the room, he says, is that for many reasons, many parents don't have the ability or the wherewithal to instill positive social values into their own children.
We need to reteach children what being a man is, being what being a woman is. Because, you know, I think, you know, over the years, we're losing that, you know. And I try to tell them that manhood is not just taking care of your family, but also taking care of your community.
From Principal Powell's perspective, interacting with parents can be a precarious tightrope walk, especially when higher school expectations mean holding children to a higher bar.
They just want the best. So sometimes they don't want to hear, you know, negative things that are happening and how we can address them to make them change and make them think differently.
This can be especially challenging given that many of the parents are in their late teens or early 20s themselves, a point Rosalinda Harris harps on.
You got to look at the ratio. It's kids having kids. So you can't expect no more than what the heck you get in the neighborhood that we live in. They just get up in the morning, come in here with their pajamas on, drop their kids off. This is a daycare.
Another point Rosalinda says can't be ignored is the fact that some of the parents are the very criminal element that drives unrest in the community.
Some of these kids, they think their mom and dad is the baddest people ever walk the earth, so they come into school and be bullies.
With these realities in mind, while Abdullah admires the turnaround attempt, he doesn't believe it will amount to much without doubling down on holistic, whole child instruction that puts ethics and character development at the center.
There's more focus on math and reading, you know, because that's what's really tested, you know. But at the expense of what?
That's Act Two of Turnaround on the special edition of Radio Times. WHYY education reporter Kevin McCory's documentary about reform efforts at Blaine Elementary School in Philadelphia.
At the parent meeting I mentioned earlier, as many adults vocalized complaints, one man sat silently in the back of the room. I had hoped to talk with him after the meeting ended, but he slipped away before I could. The next day, though, the phone at my desk rang. A few days later, I visited a man named Keith Gray on his block.
Well, what made me call you was it seemed like you only get a one-side story of the school and what was going on there.
Keith Gray's grandson, Keith, will enter the first grade this year. Through little Keith's kindergarten year, Gray volunteered at the school most days. He had asked Principal Powell for my number.
But she didn't ask me to do this. I just thought it wasn't fair.
As we talked, we sat in a leafy abandoned lot across from his house, where the neighbors maintain the grass and have patio furniture and barbecue grills set up. Gray helped little Keith with his homework.
What are we doing? It says color the pictures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Circle the correct word that matches each picture. Then you have to write the word here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in 2009, when little Keith was still in his mother's womb, his father, also named Keith, was murdered.
Well, he was at a nightclub in down Center City, Third Market. Got into an argument with another guy. And I think they were pushing and shoving, whatever have you. It was squashed.
The bouncer kicked the other guy out first.
And then my son came out, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes later, and as soon as he walked out the door, the guy confronted him. They struggled, and the guy shot him in the chest. That was that.
Keith's son was 29 years old. Little Keith's mother was 5.5 months pregnant. Over the next few years, Gray stayed in his grandson's life, and the more time he spent with him, the more he could see that he really needed him. Little Keith should have started kindergarten in September 2014 with the rest of the kids at Blaine, but living with his mom, it wasn't happening.
I'm kind of a stickler for education, but she wasn't so much. So that's when I totally just said, just let him stay here with me, and I can get him there every day.
In early October, little Keith moved in with his grandfather full-time. At that point, he had missed weeks of school.
He needed to be with me so he could get to school. I'll just put it to you that way. You can read in between the lines. Other than that, he would constantly been late and wouldn't have been there.
Gray began to relish the new routine. Every morning, they'd get up at 6:45, brush their teeth together, and eat breakfast. He'd iron little Keith's clothes, pack him a lunch, and then walk him and a few of the other kids on the block to school. The more time he spent with little Keith, the more he reminded him of his own son.
They're the same. They actually look alike. He's outspoken, very inquisitive, wants to know everything. He's like the reincarnation of his father.
This time, though, Gray is counting on a much different outcome.
I don't know. A second chance to any mistakes I might have made with the first. I get to do over. It's like a do-over. Getting a little emotional there.
He says the biggest mistake he made with his son was not spending enough time with him as a boy.
You know, it's not money or anything, it's the time that you spend. And that's the biggest thing that I learned. You know, you can pay what you need to pay and all that, but if you're not spending time with it, it's just like, I mean, what are you doing?
During school hours, Gray works the sign-in desk at Blaine and helps keep order during lunch periods. Being there almost every day, Gray says he's gotten a day-to-day view of the turnaround attempt.
What have I seen? I've seen a hard job that the teachers...
Hard job.
Stop, Keith. A hard job that the teachers have there.
He says the school has served little Keith especially well. He came into school behind, but is now caught up and is near a first-grade level of abilities.
He's learning. He likes to go to school. That's self-explanatory, too. He likes to go to school. He doesn't like missing school.
Blaine's turnaround effort is not yet a story with a definitive ending. There's been no triumphant celebrations, nor any sorrowful admissions of defeat. After year one of what Principal Powell sees as a 5-year process, they are still very much in the midst of the work. And views on how to measure the success of such an effort differ. One way is to simply track the collected data points and compare the year-to-year results. Essentially, did the state test scores go up? Did the rate of violent incidents go down? In Blaine's case, the answer to both questions is no. But the numbers are tricky. The state says its tests got a lot harder last year, so comparisons to the previous year are unfair. As for reported violent incidents, they went up from 4 to 11. But Principal Powell says the data doesn't tell the real story, because staff in previous years didn't always follow through in documenting incidents. Another way to evaluate the turnaround is much more subjective.
Last year it was a tragedy, it was crazy, but it's way better now.
Parent Tierra White's 5th-grade daughter has been at Blaine since kindergarten.
The teachers are better. They do more stuff. They got more activities.
Some of the students testified to that as well. 6th-grader Kareem Presley spoke with me in the schoolyard.
And is it better?
A little bit.
How?
Because there are less fights.
Why do you think that is?
Because different teachers and new rules.
From Kareem's perspective, there were more consequences for misbehavior.
Were you one of the kids who got in fights before?
Yes.
You were?
Huh?
And why would you get in fights?
People were trying to mess with me.
Do they still try to mess with you?
No.
Because of the rules?
Yes.
Principal Powell says, actually, the rules didn't change. What changed, she says, is now all faculty members are singing from the same hymnal.
I mean, we did those things, but maybe all the children didn't know the process, right? I think we're very transparent and everybody knows what's going to happen. So this year, it's everybody knows, all the staff know, all the students know, the parents know.
As the year rolled on, math teacher Andrew Brooking judged progress in academics and culture day by day.
I said, like, every day I want to go home and it's either, like, a good day or a bad day, good day, bad day.
Good days were those when his classrooms would be humming, students were engaged, and you could see the light in their eyes growing. On bad days, gains seemed marginal, and the challenges of the neighborhood insurmountable. As the seasons changed, good days gathered momentum.
Overall, I mean, I can count on my hand that I went home and had a day that I was like, oh, this is horrible.
For some, Blaine's turnaround will forever be marked by the sudden, drastic shakeup in faculty. Rashid Abdullah, the teacher who's been at Blaine longer than anyone, says the shakeup did bring in some really good teachers. He says many of those who were pushed to leave hadn't been at the school that long and didn't have much buy-in. But there were a few teachers, people who'd been there a while, whom he really misses, ones who he knew gave their all to the kids.
I think we lost some of those types of teachers. And I think that's very important to the success of the teacher and to the success of the students, because the students can, you know, can kind of feel you out. And they know if you truly care or not.
But to Maureen Brower, the teacher from the very beginning of the story, there's no doubt the shakeup was the right thing to do.
I really see a difference with the adults in the building just kind of collaborating and really working together to make this a great school.
One of the true tests of the effort will be whether the new teachers actually stay. That was a question Andrew Brooking wrestled with throughout the year. For him, the turning point came in the spring. By then, he felt truly immersed in the school community. He felt supported by Principal Powell and the rest of the staff, and he began to really see the difference the turnaround was having. That last point crystallized for him at a faculty meeting late in the year. Staff met to compare their goals at the beginning of the turnaround process with their progress thus far.
When I sat back and I looked at each category, I was like, wow, and I said it to the whole team. I was like, okay, like, I can sit back and say I'm sorry for, I don't know if it's pushing us, but sorry for feeling like we're not ever doing good enough work.
It was in that meeting that Brooking was struck by Blaine's momentum.
I was like, no, we've done a lot of work. We have to start somewhere.
For Principal Powell, many challenges remain. School culture is far from perfect. Too many students still too often arrive at school late, and budget concerns continue to permeate everything. But Powell is not just hopeful, she's confident.
I know that our children are growing. I believe that any child who comes here, if I just know where they are, even if they're 2-3 years below level, I will take them at least a year and a half within that year. I know that our children will grow.
Of last year's faculty, all but 4 members have returned for year 2. 2 took administrative positions in other schools. 2 are now teaching elsewhere. Andrew Brooking is one of those who has returned. At the end of the year, he came to Principal Powell to tell her he'd commit to at least the full 5-year turnaround.
I can see the change in our kids. I can feel the change. I can see more desire. I mean, it's 1 year, but to see them from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, I feel proud of the work that they've done and that I've done. And I feel like if I were to walk away, it would be detrimental to the school. And that's not just me as a person. I feel like the work that's done, the foundation is set, and I feel like that needs to be consistent now.
As the turnaround effort moves into its 2nd year, its success or failure will not be contingent on Principal Powell or Maureen Brower or Andrew Brooking or Rashid Abdullah or any one individual. What became clear through reporting this story, the turnaround of a school such as Blaine Elementary can only thrive in the long term if all parties acknowledge the critical importance of the work. From school and district leaders, to teachers, to parents, to the students themselves, to city and state politicians, to citizens across the Commonwealth, the responsibility is shared.
turnaround a year inside a Strawberry Mansion Elementary School was written and reported by Kevin McCory, edited by Chris Satullo, produced by Shai Binyakov and Kevin McCory, with additional help from Charlie Kyer, Adam Staniszewski, and Naomi Starobin. For more information about turnaround, go to the NewsWorks website, newsworks.org. Well, the new school year in Philadelphia starts today. What's ahead for Blaine? Will those ambitious plans and ideas continue? Will they bear fruit? What can we learn from Blaine? And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Kevin McCory, WHYY Newswork senior education reporter, a writer, I should say. And Kevin, congratulations on this story.
Thank
and thanks
you,
for joining us. Also with us is Kate Shaw. She is the Executive Director of Research for Action. That's a nonprofit educational research organization here in Philadelphia. And Kate Shaw, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marnie.
You're welcome. Kevin, let me begin with you. We were sitting here listening with our listeners to your report. You've been an education reporter for a number of years here in Philadelphia. What did you learn that you did not know spending an entire year focusing on Blaine?
I think just going into school and seeing how difficult the work is, how difficult the challenges are, and really getting an up-close view in the day-to-day of the different parents that we heard in that story, the different kids that you heard in that story, and just how hard it is when we're talking about getting everybody on the same page to agree to one vision and then trying to make a difference in these children's lives. It's incredible that this work happens at all. And when it happens well, it's a miracle.
Well, and what struck me is obviously the challenges inside the classroom, getting a team of teachers that can work with the principal. But then you've got this outside environment that has such a huge impact.
You can't deny that, right? I mean, that it's when we talk about Philadelphia neighborhood schools specifically that serve students from a neighborhood, that's what you're doing. You're treating and serving that neighborhood. And that comes with a lot of trauma and problems and issues that you can't avoid. You can't just say we're only going to talk about reading and math today. You can do that in classrooms where you've already had a support structure that allows you to do that.
Kate, what did you hear from this documentary?
Well, I want to add my congratulations to Kevin. It is an incredibly important thing that you've done, Kevin, because I think it helps us move away from thinking about schools in terms of test scores and even in terms of just raw bottom line dollars. I think what Kevin saw at Blaine is what I think, you know, a building body of evidence from the research community is showing, which is that turnaround is a process. There's no end point to turnaround. It takes a long time. It takes an incredible amount of talent and devotion. And I think Blaine is an interesting case because, as Kevin points out, it is a neighborhood school.
That's right.
The turnaround model is not top-down, as the Promise Academies were in a previous round of reforms, nor is it charter-based. It's, you know, a principal that has a long-standing track record at Blaine and had developed, a sense of trust and commitment from her teachers. And it's a bunch of talented teachers, you know, traditional teachers from the school district. And I think it's really important that we see what can happen in a place like Blaine, which obviously is plagued by a whole lot of problems. But, you know, even in the first year, maybe we don't see huge increases in test scores. I think we see some changes in test scores, but nothing dramatic. But what we do see is sort of the organizational change that precedes real academic changes, right? So we see teachers saying that they see students that are more engaged and happier to come to school. We have parents reporting the same thing. We hear teachers expressing confidence in a principal. We hear a principal talking about her own confidence and her own commitment to this mission. And I think those are the building blocks that need to be in place as the turnaround process rolls out. Those are the things that need to be there in order for real increases in academic achievement to be realized.
And we were talking about this while listening to this documentary about the important role that principals play, and perhaps, Kate, even the critical role that they play. Jeanine Powell seems like an incredible principal, and she has gathered a team around her. She's working long hours. They're working long hours. And I kind of scribbled some notes to myself. Are we asking too much?
Well, I mean, listening to Principal Power, listening to Andrew Bricking, you have to worry about burnout. You hear both of them say they don't have a personal life. You hear Andrew say he can't even think about having kids and having, you know, what most of us would consider a normal life because he's so focused on this. And it's, you know, it's humbling to see how devoted these folks are to Blaine, but at how do we replicate this, and how do we turn these schools around without burning out all of these really talented folks? And I think that's a big question for the school district, but it's not unique to Philadelphia. It's happening all over the country. How do we sustain the kind of commitment and momentum that we see at Blaine over a long period of time so that the school doesn't backtrack if they have a turnover?
I think what Andrew would say to that, too, is that he knows that the first few years of this especially are going to be difficult, and that he hopes by then they've built the infrastructure to really make it so he doesn't have to, you know, sacrifice his own life to do this work. It just kind of rolls forward. And that's the schools where you see, I think, significant change, and you see teachers willing to come back year after year. That's what's happening.
Right. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, the principal talks about open doors. I mean, literally having open doors to the classrooms. The parents talk about the fact that the children are in uniforms and that the school looks nice. And there's a lot of talk about data as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, just how revolutionary is this?
Well, maybe it's not revolutionary. Those things are done. I mean, to a certain extent, those are the physical, tactile things you can see and feel at first glance, and they certainly matter. And I think that, you know, they all send a signal to the kids in that building that we're trying something and this matters and we're thinking
these
and caring about you.
Symbols.
Yeah, that definitely matters. And as far as the data sharing and the use of technology, I think that, you know, you can almost take for granted just how difficult it is to get 30, 40 teachers in a building on the same page and then the parents on the same page communicating the same message to students, and that seems to be helping tremendously in this case.
Go ahead, Kay.
Well, and as exciting as all of this is, you know, from every standpoint, from the teachers, from the principals, from the parents, you keep hearing about the fact that you can only get so far without adequate resources.
Right.
And I think Kevin's story shows the complexity of the situation and gets us out of that sort of dichotomous argument that we often see among folks that are in the ed reform circles. But, I mean, you know, you hear about this little boy, Chance Harris.
That's right.
And you hear about the fact that, you know, his life is at stake because there's no full-time nurse in that school. And there's a lot of kids like that in Philadelphia. And, you know, one of the things that we know about Blaine is that 25% of those kids are special ed kids, but we hear that in Blaine, many people don't even know about Chance's IEP. I mean, these are things that can't be addressed without adequate resources. The fact that he got beaten up and doesn't feel safe in that school speaks to what it means when we don't have enough resources, because we don't have enough people in those buildings to take care of those children. And Principal Powell could be working 24 hours a day, and she would not be able to handle all of those things.
I'm also thinking of Chance's biological father is in prison.
Mm-hmm.
His stepfather was killed.
Mm-hmm.
His mom sounds like she's got some health problems,
mm-hmm.
as he does as well. And just, Kevin, just to sort of help our listeners understand, you put all that stuff together, and it's a difficult thing for a little boy to grow up with those kinds of losses.
You can only imagine, right? And honestly, when you talk to him, he seems very cheery, and
does he
seems a fun kid to be around. And, you know, he doesn't seem like he's letting the world weigh down on him. Now, his mom admits, he'll even admit that sometimes he's a behavioral problem at school because he's kind of acting out, and he's been bullied at the school, and he's kind of learned how to interact in this community. And they all acknowledge that he needs to work on that, and he does too. But yeah, to your point, Marty, I mean, it's some pretty substantial deficits that he's up against.
And which maybe explains the 25% of special education.
Exactly. And I also think it's important to note that Blaine is an elementary school, and we know from research done all over the country that it's much more difficult to turn around high schools.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing at Blaine is really hopeful, and there's some real progress that's being made here. But I think had Kevin spent a year in a comprehensive high school in Philadelphia, the picture might not have been as positive because it's much more difficult. Because all the issues that we see at Blaine that are being addressed sort of in the early years, when those aren't addressed and kids get to high school, you have, you know, it's not much more difficult.
And one of the teachers talks about just, especially with young children, how much promise they have. I mean, they come to the school sparkly-eyed and, you know, ready to learn. And the question is, how do you maintain that?
Yeah, that's Rashid Abdullah, and
that's right.
You know, he's a pretty amazing individual to meet and speak to, and has devoted his, you know, 22-year career to that school. And, you know,
you know, Kate, when you have 20 years in the Philadelphia School District, you can go wherever you want. You can teach wherever you want.
Right.
And he's chosen to stay at this school because that's where he feels like the kids need him.
What's ahead for this year? And I guess, I mean, obviously the first year you're kind of establishing some of the infrastructure to put some of these ideas into effect.
Yeah, and the work keeps going. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, technical conversation around how they're going to implement curriculum. And I know that Common Core and the different ways that the tests have changed are a major concern there. And Andrew Brooking, who we heard in the story, is becoming the leader of the math curricula, and he's writing and developing that and trying to figure out how he's going to adjust to the new standards in the school. And, you know, so it's, you know, there's larger context here that drives this conversation. We obviously talk about the city and the state responsibility and the politics and the funding that goes all around that. And I tried to, you know, illustrate how these things play out in a single school, right?
And in the piece, Kate, there's talk about that. Kevin talks about the funding formula. And I think for some parents and others, they might not know exactly what that refers to. How does Pennsylvania do funding of education?
As Kevin points out, Pennsylvania has the most inequitable funding of public schools in the country. And there is a new funding formula on the table, and part of what that funding formula would do would be to provide more resources for exactly these kind of kids, more resources for kids with special education needs, more resources for kids that live in poverty. And that would, if the formula is enacted and if we have adequate funding to put behind the formula, what you'll see at Blaine is you'll see a full-time nurse, you'll see more safety in that school, and you'll see supports for Principal Powell. So that Principal Powell doesn't have to be the CEO of a school. She can rely on a rich array of other professionals to help her with those kids so that she can focus on the academic climate at the school and support her teachers as they work to increase the achievement of their students.
Do you like the idea of sort of bottom-up reforms? I mean, the idea is that an innovative principal can institute some ideas that, in this case, she thinks will work for these students?
I think it's a great idea, but it all depends on the quality of the principal and of the teachers. And so when it works because you have the kind of talent that you're seeing at Blaine. And I think the issue always with public education reform is how do you scale that? How do you make sure you have enough of these kinds of principals, and how do you support them? Because it's such a difficult job for them. How do you find the kind of teachers that'll put in 60, 70-hour weeks the way that Andrew Brooking is putting in until the school begins to turn around? I think that's really the issue. So bottom-up reform helps address some of the problems that we've already seen with top-down reform and some of the reforms that are currently being debated in Harrisburg. But in order for that bottom-up reform to really work, you've got to find a way to find the talent and support the talent and make sure that those folks have the supports that they need so that they can continue doing this kind of terrific job.
I'll say citywide, you know, so much of the reporting and the talk about education can be about the funding models and the politics and all that. There's so many teachers who I meet and I know who just have to block all of it out and say, all I can do, all I can focus on is my school and my classroom. And I put all that, you know, to them, the BS aside, because what else am I going to do? And you see a certain amount of that in this school. And, you know, it's just people saying, this is our school, this is our community, and we're going to do this together. And, you know, you talk to them, they don't know, they don't trust even necessarily the Philadelphia School District. They don't know their values or their what they want. They don't know and trust the state politicians, the city politicians. But I think that, to Kate's point, it's only ever going to work in the long term if, yes, the school is on the same page and the teachers and the principal there are working as hard as they can to implement one vision. But at the same time, they know that they're being supported at the next level up, and then the next level up, and then the next level up. And if that's not all then trickling back down, then, yeah, how is this work going to be sustainable?
And Kate, we met some pretty extraordinary parents, and in one case, a grandparent in this school as well. And, I, you know, having probably talked to you and other people about how to make good schools, the parents play such a critical role, and they have to feel part of what's going on there.
Right. There's some really interesting research that came out of Chicago that compared 100 poor-performing elementary schools with 100 elementary schools that made significant progress in turning things around. And they identified five essential elements of the high-performing schools. And these were all schools in Chicago. All of them were probably underfunded. And here's the five things they saw in the schools that did well. They saw effective leaders, collaborative teachers, strong family and community ties, ambitious instruction, and safe and orderly learning climate. Hmm. And as I was listening to Kevin's documentary, I had this list in front of me, and I was thinking, I wonder how many of these are actually in place at Blaine. I mean, clearly effective leadership is in place. Clearly collaborative teaching is in place. It's not so clear that strong family and community ties have really taken hold. It's not completely clear that there's a safe and orderly learning climate. In fact, it sounds like maybe there isn't, given Chance's situation. And so, that's a question for you, Kevin. What's your mm-hmm. sense of sort of where the school is with regard to these essential elements?
I would say that, that third one you said, the safe and orderly climate, I think that that's something that they acknowledge that they're working on constantly. That's of utmost importance. And there's probably days where it is, and there's maybe moments and days where it isn't.
Right.
As far as the other one, strong family and community ties, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right, in neighborhood public education. They're clearly trying. You know, the parent meeting that kind of led me to both Rosalinda Harris and Keith Gray, you know, that's something that they were doing throughout the year, inviting parents in, trying to get people engaged. You know, you only got a dozen people showing up.
Right.
And then sometimes those dozen people have complaints about something else.
Right.
And you can't really have the conversation that you had wanted to have. So there's people out there who are trying to do this stuff. Do you have any ideas, Kate?
In 10 seconds or less.
Well, I know that the New York Public Schools are trying to turn towards a community schools model as a way to co-locate services for communities and families and draw parents and community in that way. So that's a hopeful reform model that we need to look more closely at.
Well, again, to you, Kevin, thank you so much for allowing us on Radio Times to debut your documentary, Turnaround, A Year Inside a Strawberry Mansion Elementary School. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty. It happen.
You're very welcome. And you can go to Newsworks' website, newsworks.org, for more information around Turnaround or about Turnaround. And Kate Shaw, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as
You're
well.
You're welcome.
And she is the Executive Director of Research for Action. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and tell us what you think about this documentary. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. But do stay with us. We'll be right back with hour two of Radio Times. And coming up next on Radio Times, how a fifth grade history class gone wrong became the inspiration for Underground Railroad story. And it had its premiere at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Our guests are the creators and actors in this play. That's ahead here at 11 on WHYY.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY and invites you to take a guided collection tour for the ultimate Barnes experience, featuring artist-themed tours like Cézanne, Picasso, and Matisse, or tours that illuminate Barnes's unrivaled eye and the masterpieces in the collection. Guided tours are available daily or select Tuesdays for exclusive access when the Barnes is closed to the public. Reservations at barnesfoundation.org or 215-278-7200.
Get more interesting. Listen to WHYY-FM Philadelphia.
WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City.
WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse.
WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton.
WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin.
And WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The Philadelphia Fringe Festival is underway and runs through September 19th. Jennifer Kidwell and Scott Shepard's Underground Railroad game is one of the many productions being presented at venues across the city. Their play is inspired by an assignment in Scott's fifth grade history class gone wrong. Their show, which they wrote and star in, explores race relations, the N-word, slavery, middle school, and it's irreverently funny. We'll hear from Kidwell and Scott about how they put this show together, their work in theater, and what's ahead for them. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.